From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Cocaine-laced cough syrup, cold water baths, tobacco toothpaste. When George Washington came down with a cold, his physicians bled him of several pints of blood, which may well have hastened his death. Modern medicine has come a long way since these bizarre, ineffective, and downright dangerous treatments. We hear from internist Dr. Lydia Kang about her new book, Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything, which describes in detail strange and shocking medical practices of yore. Practices like the use of blood-sucking leeches.
Unlike a lancet and a big blood vessel in your arm, you could bleed close to the site where someone was not feeling well. So if they had a headache, you could bleed around their temples.
On the record, after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Strange and gross, fascinating and mystifying. The path humans have taken to reach modern medical practices is filled with bizarre twists and turns. Doctors used to commonly recommend substances like tobacco or cocaine that we now know as dangerous. And routine hygiene practices we take for granted, like hand washing and bathing, were once overlooked by physicians. The book Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything, explores weird and wacky medical uses of elements, plants, tools, animals, as well as curious and sometimes cringeworthy methods of treatment. Dr. Lydia Kang is a practicing internal medicine physician and co-author of Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything, published by Workman Publishing. Welcome to On the Record.
Thanks for having me.
How did this idea for a compendium of bizarre medical practices come about?
Well, Nate Peterson, who is a journalist and a librarian, is a friend of mine. And one day he said, we really should write a book together. It was actually his wife's idea, April Tucholsky, who is also a young adult author like myself. And he said, I would love to do a book on quacks. And I thought that would be a fantastic idea because being a physician, a lot of people don't realize this, but in medical school, we get absolutely no history of medicine course. And I knew some things, I wanted to know more, and it was a perfect time to just delve in and get into the nitty-gritty of some of the horrible things that we used to do to take care of ourselves.
In the acknowledgments, you and your co-author, Nate Peterson, thank librarians for not calling the police when you ask for help finding sources on cannibalism, blood jam, opium, other odd things. Tell me about the research process for Quackery.
The process was pretty straightforward. We started out by a very brief look into everything that we could find that seemed pretty ridiculous that we had either heard about ourselves or with a little bit of research started to find out and uncover more and more about, for example, the corpse and cannibalism medicine. Once we got some of those ideas, we started to dig deeper, and it really was going down the veritable rabbit hole. We kept going deeper, going to as many primary resources as we could find until we really got as far as we could. And then we had to sort of regroup and decide what we were going to keep and what we weren't going to keep. And probably the hardest thing was figuring out how to put it together in a way that would be really entertaining to people, because we didn't want it to be a boring history of medicine. We wanted it to be funny and ridiculous and hard to believe, but also very absorbable in a lot of ways.
Well, it is funny and ridiculous, but why was that clear to you that this book ought to be funny and ridiculous?
Well, some of our favorite nonfiction books, Mary Roach and several others who write, have this wonderful flair for making it so entertaining while you're learning something that can be actually a little bit gruesome. And we wanted to keep that lighthearted humor because otherwise it does get a little bit dry and it gets a little bit old. And we didn't want to put it together in such a way that it was, let's start from the dawn of man and work our way to the present. We wanted to do it via focusing on the specific specific topics. So, for example, we have a whole chapter on leeches, and I got to look up everything I wanted to about leeches. I probably know way more about them than I ever thought I would, but I was laughing the whole time because some of it was too unbelievable to believe.
Yeah, a lot of this book is. So since you have mentioned leeches, let me ask you about bloodletting. Why did physicians think that removing blood would cure disease?
Well, it's a very, very old concept. So the idea really stems from the humoral medicine theory of how the body worked. Since the time of Hippocrates, they believed that your body was really dictated by these four major elements: blood, phlegm, yellow bile, and black bile. And when one of these elements was out of whack in your body, you got sick. So if you had too much phlegm because you have a cold, or if you had fevers, you know, they could say that it was from one of these things, and the best way to even out the humors would be to, for example, cause someone to purge them out. And different ways of purging included lots of saliva production, enormous amounts of vomiting, medicines like mercury that would give you terrible diarrhea, and bloodletting. And bloodletting was really commonly used because they thought that blood was the one humor that always had a tendency to be in excess and was just the troublemaker. So bloodletting was used for anything from fevers to rashes, people who are melancholy, people who are too excitable, mental illness. I mean, you name it, and bloodletting was used for treating it.
And President George Washington may have died due to bloodletting?
Yes, President Washington, he had an episode of what was probably an epiglottitis, some inflammation in his throat. And his physicians wanted to try to make him better, and part of the armamentaria that they had at the time was bloodletting. So he was bled a few pints the next day, bled again. He got sicker and sicker, and they don't know for sure if the bloodletting was the absolute cause of his death, but it absolutely contributed to it.
And that was bloodletting by cutting him, right? Letting blood flow out of a vein?
That's correct. Yes. They used to call that breathing a vein. It was a very poetic way of saying it. But oftentimes the typical method would be to put a tourniquet on the upper arm, and they would use a lancet and cut into the large vein of the arm and bleed it into a bowl.
But you mentioned leeches were also used to get blood out of a human being. Why?
Yeah, so leeches were used very commonly, and they were used for a very similar reason for the blood. They wanted to get rid of this excess amount of blood that they thought was harmful. But leeches are a very particular method because, one, when they bite you, it doesn't hurt at all. People probably can tell stories of when they've waded into a muddy river, came out with leeches, and had no idea that they were there. So in a lot of ways, it was a bit of a more humane method.
It's hard to think of leeches as a humane method.
It is hard to, but it was so common, and it was so such a normal part of the culture that people didn't really feel that disgusted by it. Apothecary jars were filled with leeches. Physicians would bring them around and bring them to their patients. So because of the normalcy of it, I think there was less of an ick factor. But the leeches were very handy because, unlike a lancet and a big blood vessel in your arm, you could bleed close to the site where someone was not feeling well. So if they had a headache, you could bleed around their temples. If they were having female problems, you could bleed down near her nether regions. And you could use multiple different kinds of leeches. You could even use them internally. So some people had their tonsils leached. Some people had rectal leeching done. I mean, there was no end to the way that they used these creatures.
And where do doctors get leeches?
People would actually use themselves as bait sometimes. They would wade into muddy waters in England or Europe, come out with the leeches, pluck them off, and sell them to physicians and apothecaries. But the leech demand became so huge over the course of several centuries that the specific leech that they liked the best, it was the European medicinal leech, was farmed in Europe, and millions of leeches in France and across Europe were imported to England. Sometimes these leech farms were just terrible, terrible scenarios. You know, they would take these old, decrepit horses or cows, slash up their sides, and push them into these muddy waters to feed the leeches. But the demand was really quite extraordinary.
Arsenic, you know, we think of it as a poison for killing rats and pests, but arsenic was also used to treat a wide array of illnesses. Which ones?
So arsenic was used for a long time for many different types of illnesses. There was a really popular drink in the 1900s called Fowler's Solution that had an arsenic compound in it. And people would drink this solution. They would drink it for beauty because they thought it would make their complexion really nice. They would apply it to their skin, for example, if they had eczema or psoriasis. And in some cases, it probably did work for some of these skin conditions where your skin got very thick. People drank it as a tonic, which is a really typical type of medicine that was out there on the shelves, something that just boosted up your energy, made you feel better, made you feel like you were doing something healthy for yourself. But if you drank too much of it, it was quite poisonous.
And there was a village where people would sprinkle arsenic on their bread?
That is true. So there is a lore in the 1850s of these arsenic eaters in an area called Styria, which is now a part of Austria. But there was this belief at the time that there was a lore of a young peasant girl who ate arsenic and was incredibly beautiful. And some physicians had told of, yeah, apparently there are people in this area, they eat arsenic, they don't die from it, and they're incredibly healthy. So this lore went on for some time and really fed into the idea that arsenic-containing medicines and solutions could be healthy. But apparently the story goes is that that peasant girl who was so beautiful and men were just pining after her, she did end up dying from arsenic poisoning, unfortunately.
That's Dr. Lydia Kang here on The Record on WYPR. She's a native of the Baltimore area, graduate of Roland Park Country School. We're talking about her new book, Quackery, a wacky and humorous encyclopedia of weird medical practices through history. She'll be in Baltimore Thursday evening to speak about it. Today we know cocaine is a dangerously addictive substance. But in the 19th century, cocaine was a popular ingredient in many medications, including suppositories and toothache drops. Cocaine was actually an ingredient in the early versions of Coca-Cola. Tell us about it.
The origins of the drink go back to the time of the Civil War. There was a soldier there whose name was John Pemberton, who almost lost his life there. And he was also a pharmacist in his civilian life. And he, after the war and after his injuries, really wanted to find a way to treat pain in a way that wasn't actually morphine, because there were a lot of issues with morphine addiction. And he decided to do some more investigation into the coca plant, which is this South American shrub that had become a little bit more popular in Europe and in France as this sort of cure-all. It was found in a very popular wine. So he took that and patented a alcoholic cocaine-laced drink that he sold everywhere and did incredibly had very, very good sales, and the drink was eventually called Coca-Cola.
And how long did cocaine stay in the Coca-Cola formula?
Not for too much longer. 1886 was around the time when Coca-Cola was first on the market. By the time we hit 1905, there was just an infinitesimal amount of cocaine in the actual drink. And then by around 1929, Coca-Cola no longer had any cocaine in it whatsoever. It still, I believe, though, has an extract of the coca plant. It's just cocaine-free.
Is cocaine used in medicine today?
Very rarely, no. The last time that I looked this up to see if it was even in the pharmacopoeia, it was. But it's very clearly says that it's almost never used anymore because we have so many other good anesthetics available.
Cold water became a popular treatment for different ailments during the early 1800s. How is that treatment administered?
It's funny because we think of this as very common sense. Drinking water to keep yourself healthy, bathing wounds with clean water. That was actually the treatment, and it was considered pretty renegade at the time. Remember, this was when people didn't bathe very often. This is when wound care was not done in a way that made a whole lot of sense. And so in the early 1800s, when the sort of father of what we call hydropathy or the cold water cure, he he started out because he had a wound. And instead of just lying in bed and letting it take him over, he started to bathe with it, bathe cold water over it, drink a lot of cold water, and he miraculously got better. For a lot of good reasons. You know, hygiene is a good thing, and being well hydrated is a good thing. And it turned into a cure that sort of took over Europe. It became incredibly popular, and these hydropathic institutes opened up all over the place. And very famous people like Charles Dickens and Alfred Lord Tennyson went to these types of institutes to be healthy.
And so, looking back on it, was it that hydrotherapy led to hygiene? Was that why that treatment had some good effect?
I think so. I think there's definitely a link between the idea that bathing could be something that was healthy and good for you, as well as the idea that, you know, bathing things that need cleansing, like wounds, was actually healthy as well.
Huh. Another non-invasive but ineffective method of treating illness, light. Both light bulbs and blue glass were thought to have healing properties.
People believe that if you had blue panels of glass inside one of your rooms or sitting under a blue glass under the sun would fix all sorts of problems, diseases and illness. And when you actually think about the physics of it, if you are standing under a blue glass, you actually probably absorb less blue light than if you were just under the sun by itself. But of course, people didn't know that. And after a certain amount of time and a very scathing review by Scientific American, people realized that blue glass was probably more bunk than good.
So how do we get from that to an idea that light does have a place in modern medicine?
There are so many things in this book which shockingly ended up in mainstream medicine today. And we do know that light has a really important effect on the body. It's instrumental in helping people produce vitamin D. Little infants sometimes who are suffering from jaundice are placed under lights to help metabolize away some of that bilirubin. So light can be incredibly helpful, but probably the commonality with these modern treatments that you see throughout the book are that they're used for a very particular and narrow index of what can actually be helpful, whereas in the past it was, this treatment will cure everything.
Okay, that's exactly what I want to pick up on in the next part of our show after we take a quick break here on The Record. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with Dr. Lydia Kang, internal medicine physician and co-author of Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Way to Cure Everything. When we come back, we'll talk about how some of the specious cures shaped medicine today. This is On The Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Medical Oddities, Morbid Curiosities. The new book, Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Way to Cure Everything, describes in great detail strange and shocking medical practices of yore. From the days of prescribing Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup, which was laced with morphine, to rubbing powder laden with mercury on the gums of teething toddlers, modern medicine has come a long way. I'm speaking with the co-author of Quackery, Dr. Lydia Kang, an internal medicine physician who grew up in the Baltimore area. Some of the practices we've talked about, like cold water or light therapy, were totally ineffective at improving someone's health. Why did people fall for what seems to be so obviously a snake oil solution?
Well, there's so many reasons why these things went on for years and years, sometimes centuries, sometimes millennia. And part of it is they didn't have anything better. And so this was really the standard of care at the time. Part of it was the fact that we have a lot of biases that affect us when we think about treatments. Someone tells us very vehemently that it's going to work, and that bias affects us and makes us think it's more likely to work. If we have friends who are going to use things, we sort of jump on the bandwagon. That's called the bandwagon effect, and we want to use them as well. But some of the things are also as simple as we didn't have a good understanding of the human body and how it worked and how diseases worked. And so, for example, syphilis is a disease, an infectious disease that ran rampant for such a very long time. And the interesting thing about syphilis is that it's very episodic. You'll get one stage and people will reach for mercury or this treatment or that treatment, but it will go away on its own. This is the natural history of syphilis. And then a year or two later, you might get this rash all over and you think, okay, it's back. Let me try something else. And that too will go away on its own. And so there was a lot of misunderstanding with how diseases worked and tied into the idea that maybe these things went away when actually they were going away on their own and had nothing to do with the actual treatments that were being used.
Or the symptoms were going away. Will people in the future write this kind of book about our approach to medicine now?
Absolutely. They will. There are so many things that we still don't understand how to treat, and we don't have the right kinds of medicines and therapies for everything that actually can go wrong with the human body. And that's really frustrating. So we do have treatments now that I think someday will be absolutely obsolete. For example, treatment of type 1 diabetes. We're injecting, patients are injecting themselves with insulin, but someday there's going to be a treatment for it that just doesn't even need that anymore. There won't be needles involved. It will be something where we can look back and say, remember the time when this disease was treated with needles and pills and surgery, and now we have this very easy fix? I think that's absolutely going to be the case someday.
Many of these shocking approaches eventually did lead to scientific breakthroughs, as you point out at different points in your book. How did that happen?
Well, the interesting thing is that some of these things, as we began to understand them a lot better and we studied them and we studied how they actually interacted with the human body, we began to realize that they might have some good, you know, really great therapies for us, except that once we understood how they worked and we understood that maybe they were quite toxic if you took too much of it, we were able to narrow down exactly how much to take and in what circumstances, and they became incredibly helpful. So, for example, arsenic, which is rat poison, which everybody knows is the thing that kings would use to kill other kings and people would use to kill off their parents to get their inheritance early, arsenic actually can be used in promyelocytic leukemia today. And that's a big shock to people to find out that these things, which seem kind of scary, can actually be quite helpful. But a thing to remember is that, you know, everything that's around you, everything that we eat, can be a poison. It's really all about the dose. Even plain water can kill you if you drink too much of it.
Until relatively recently, there were no gatekeepers to the practice of medicine. People could go to a barbershop and get a haircut, a tooth pulled, and get bled. It seems like the Wild West of medicine, even going into the 20th century.
It did, and a lot of that changed right around that time. But before then, you could go into your local grocery and buy opium elixirs for your babies right off the shelf. That was not a problem. And in the early 1900s, when we passed the Pure Food and Drug Act, and we started to have more laws about making sure that our foods were pure and that our medicines were actually what they said they were in the bottle and that they actually did what they promised to do, until then, it was really a free-for-all, and it was word of mouth. Even with those laws, things still slip through the cracks. So, for example, with the discovery of radium, which is this radioactive element by Marie Curie in the early 1900s, the Pure Food and Drug Act didn't cover elements. And so radium tonics, radium pills, and radium medicines and cosmetics were all over the place because people thought it was the next best wonderful thing for treating everything. And we didn't realize until a couple years into that that it could actually kill people.
What was your favorite bit of quackery that you uncovered?
My favorite bit of quackery, my favorite chapter, is probably the corpse and cannibalism chapter. Yeah. Because it's so particularly horrifying. And I didn't know at the time, you don't learn this in medical school, that people used to eat other people to try to get better. It's just the idea of it is so far-fetched, and yet it is very much grounded in our history. So for a long time, people thought that, you know, another human body that had died suddenly, quickly, at the height of their health, could confer that healthy spirit over to someone else if you were to, say, drink the blood of a fallen gladiator or rub your sores on a hanging executed criminal in England. And this was very normal. I mean, people didn't really wince. They didn't think this was gross. They thought it was okay. For hundreds of years, particularly in the 18th century, eating medicines made out of ground-up Egyptian mummies was considered to be one of the best medicines out there. And all of this was just an absolute shock to me. I couldn't believe it when I read it.
Many of us can't believe this book. Congratulations.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
Dr. Lydia Kang is a practicing internal medicine physician and co-author of Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything, published by Workman Publishing. She'll speak about it at the Maryland State Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped at 415 Park Avenue, Baltimore, on Thursday, 6:30 p.m. We have a link at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening to On the Record. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.